Hi everyone. Well, what I've put together tonight I have done in the gaps that Trixie's naps have provided me. So I hope that it's coherent and perhaps I'm in part relying on you as well. But I wanted to start by connecting what I have to say tonight on the book of Genesis with what I said last time. And I will do that, but I want to say first up that the last 3 or 4 days where I have been neck deep in Genesis, it's blown the top off my head. I mean, I knew that Genesis was an extraordinary book, but it's funny when you pay very close literary attention to a book, you realise how much you don't know and can't know, the unplumbable depths of a book like this one. So I'm really excited by the tiny, tiny bit that I had time to say tonight. It feels like the deeper you go into a book like this, the less hope you have of getting across the whole thing. I've tried to sort of do, anyway, without further ado. So I think it's an extraordinary book. It's as complex a text as any I've ever laid my hand to. Its structure, its syntax, its rhetorical complexity, its beauty, they're unplumbable. But I want to start by saying that my experience of Genesis has been just that. It somehow always escapes and envelopes its readers at the same time. And yet we come to it again and again because we're changed by it and entranced by it, which I think is the point of a literary reading. One of my favourite literary critics, Wayne Booth, suggests that the point of reading a literary text is that it generates a conversation between the text and the reader. He uses that metaphor of a conversation. I ask questions of the text, it answers, it gives me answers, but those answers change the way that I see the text and then change the next set of questions that I offer to the text. And I really feel that Genesis won such a book. It is so rich that it generates that kind of spiralling that won't ever stop till the day I die, I'm fairly sure. So I've been absolutely unable to come up with a total summative view of Genesis, which I think is appropriate, actually. So whatever I have to say today is actually provisional, and I want to give it to you as a provisional sense of what I think Genesis is about, as one set of questions that I've thrown at the text, one set of answers, and the next time I come to it, hopefully they'll be bigger and better. So yeah, come with me on the journey. Now, I think when one speaks of Genesis as literature, some Christians, and I probably would have been one of them at some point, get antsy. And the reason for that is two words, metaphor and allegory. The big question becomes, is Genesis allegorical? Is Genesis metaphorical? And if that's true, am I some kind of liberal washout? And it's interesting, Jonathan and I come from Newtown. I'm not even sure I should share this story. But apparently it's the most atheists exist in that area of anywhere else in Australia. I mentioned I was giving a talk on Genesis to one of our friends tonight, and she said, well, I think that if anybody thinks it's literal, that's a measure of their intelligence. So it's interesting when you see it from either end of the story. And I think I just want to start by saying I actually think that's the wrong question entirely. It's the wrong way to come at it. Is Genesis telling us how creation was made? I'm going to take Ian Proven's defense here. I think Genesis is entirely uninterested in how creation was made. It's interested in why creation was made, by whom creation was made, for whom creation was made. It answers those theological questions. So in some senses, it actually doesn't matter to me one way or the other, whether it's allegorical or not. I just need to say that up front, because I think that's, whenever you mention Genesis and a literary reading of it, that's what comes into the room. So I just needed to address it. But I also wanted to talk, just to rehash a little bit about what I was talking about last time we met. I spoke carefully about the precedents that I have for reading a biblical text literarily, which was Christ himself. I spoke about how Flannery O'Connor asks us to remember that Christ did not save us by direct intellectual act, if you remember, but by inhabiting a body. In the same way, literary texts and biblical texts come to us clothed in story, in metaphor, in structure, musical devices, however they come. No text can come to us without human conventions, because we can't talk without language, and language is in part human convention. So yes, texts are relative to the culture in which they're written and the culture of the person who asks questions of it. Does that limit its power to speak? I would argue that no, it doesn't. In fact, it increases the text's power to speak to us. My other question, does a text's relativity degrade its status as the Word of God? I think that question is answered now. I firmly believe that to ask this question is the same as asking this question. Does Jesus' incarnation in a human body degrade his membership in the Trinity? The answer, as any Christian will tell you, is that not only does it not degrade his membership of the Godhead, but that his salvific power depends upon his incarnation, on his inhabiting a body. So if that's true, surely I can say that our text, the biblical text's ability to speak into my life is not marred by its human and literary conventions, but it depends upon it. It depends upon it as a necessary form to communicate. So I'm linking, perhaps audaciously, the literary text and Christ himself as both incarnated. Glory be to God. All of this... Right, I've spoken about allegory and metaphor. I've just got to make sure I cover all of these. But I wanted to share with you something really funny. Funny? Interesting? As I was preparing for tonight, I was reading about... do you remember the story about... I'm speaking back to metaphor and allegory and the other big sort of elephant in the room when you talk about Genesis, you know, evolution, creation. I found this little interesting thing. Do you remember when... Jacob and Laban are separating their flocks, and Jacob says, I'll take all the spotted ones. And then Jacob gets all of the strong spotted flock, and he puts, I think it is a stick in front of them, which in those in biblical times was thought to increase fertility. So as it happened, Jacob's flock grew and grew stronger than Laban's flock. So if that is not evidence of the fact that farmers knew about natural selection well before Charles Darwin, well, I'm a monkey's uncle, in Genesis itself, no less. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. I thought that was really interesting. So the other thing I want to briefly mention before we tuck into the text itself or to talk about is the sense that the minute we admit the residence of metaphor or allegory in a text, that somehow we move further away from the truth itself. Because metaphor is representative, so the thinking goes, it's separated from the thing itself, it's less powerful. I believe this could not be further from the truth. Again, I turn to the incarnation for my defence. God saw fit to clothe himself in human flesh. There are a few examples of God's revelation of himself to humankind without any kind of fleshing. And those examples did not go so well. Remember Moses and the turning back, the veil. Metaphor is simply incarnated truth, just as Christ is incarnated in human flesh. I have absolutely no problem with Genesis using metaphor or allegory, if in fact that's what it's doing, but primarily because I think God has no problem with our fleshness. We can choose to see our anchoring in flesh as somehow a degrading of the truth or a separation from what is true, but more and more I see this kind of oblique revelation of the fullness of God is actually where the game is at. And sometimes we can't see the truth directly. We must see truth through metaphor or allegory to see what it illuminates. Just in case you missed it, the fact that I had to use a metaphor, the sun, to talk about metaphor is a right and proper example of the fact that all language, even divine scripture, are wedded to metaphor. Let's enjoy it rather than apologise for it. Okay, so now that I've got all those skeletons out of the closet, yes, another metaphor, let's do what we spoke about last time, and let's let's have a look at the text itself. So I want to talk broadly about Genesis, but also want to drill down deeply. If you remember last time I spoke about when we read literarily, we're asked to ask what is the broad questions of the text, but we're also asked to pay close attention to patterns, rhythms, repeated motifs, those kinds of things. So we're going to be doing a little bit of both of that today. If I can pull it off. So basically what I want to do is to drill down, come back up, drill down, come back up, and see if our vision of what the text is doing broadly is expanded by that coming up and down. So if we look at Genesis as a whole, we can see, first of all, a cylindrical shape, if I can say, a set of concentric circles that narrow in focus as the book moves along. So if we're looking at it broadly. If you flick through your Bible, if you've got it with you, or flick through your memory, if you don't have it, you can see the stories in this sequence. And I think I've got something here. First of all, we've got the created order. We've got the making of the created order. Then we've got Adam and Eve, the making of human order, human civilization. Then we've got Cain and Abel, the aberration of human order. Then we've got Noah. Then we've got Babel. Okay, so by the time we get to Babel, we're starting to look at civilization. And we're starting to look at cities. Can you see how it's coming? The frame is coming in. It's getting closer and closer in. Then it makes a jump, which is interesting. So it goes from there to human creation, and this is the this is Adam and Eve's exile out of the garden. And then we move to Babel, human civilization. It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. More focused, more focused, more focused. And then finally, oh, not that one. Hang on. Whoop, back. And then finally we get to the patriarchal stories. Now the patriarchal stories, I'm going to refer to them, if it's okay with you, as the patriarchal matriarchal stories, because I actually think that, well, I'm going over there. Thank you. Good, I'm glad. The matriarchs are just as important, if not more important, to the story.
They give birth to the patriarchs.
Correct. They give birth to the patriarchs. And in fact,
the mother.
That's right. Right, there'd be no birth, there'd be no genealogy. So I'm going to include the matriarchs as well. So then we go from Abraham and Sarah, Hagar and Ishmael, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Esau, then Jacob and Leah slash Rachel, Joseph and his brothers from then into exile. So you can see that the family is starting to, it goes from this sort of primordial history or the primeval history into the four generations that shape Israel. So roughly, Genesis is split into those four, sorry, those two types, I guess, of history. So two parts. The first is what has been termed the primeval history, which runs from chapters 1 through 11, and the patriarchal matriarchal narratives, which run from chapters 12 through 50. As a rule, in the first part, it's very little dialogue. It's fable-like in its scope. Human characters are rendered at a distance. We don't get to know much about what's going on in their heads. They seem more generalized, I guess, as figures. So you can see where some people have suggested, I think, that this is allegorical and metaphorical because they're spoken of in this fable-like way. Now, the patriarchal narratives, we see a different style altogether. Oh, the other thing I should mention is that the Genesis 1 through 11 seems to peer backwards into the deep past, whereas the way this the Abrahamic cycles and the following ones are narrated, you're drawn into the action such that they seem present, and then you're spat through the other side into the history, into the future of the Israelite people. So there is that kind of separation, I suppose. So in the patriarchal narratives, we see a different style. Dialogue plays a really central and powerful role. And as anyone trained in literature will tell you, you'll notice that novel writers don't write down everything that's said. They select what's said at critical junctures. It's the same here. So whenever anything is said or written down verbatim, that's a part of the shape of the story. So yeah, dialogue, bringing tension and climax to the stories. Human characters are different in personality from one another. I read one really interesting comment that said, Isaac, I'd never thought of this before, is utterly, utterly passive. Doesn't even get his own wife. Abraham sends a servant So there's this double passivity going on. It's really interesting. I've never occurred to me before, but anyway. No wonder Rebecca had to do something, you know. So the plot is fleshed out in comparatively realist detail in comparison with its primeval antecedent. And yet, while different, it's important that we try to get a sense of what Genesis as a whole is doing. They seem like two different things. So my proposition tonight is, if we can drill down into a story that exists in the primeval history, and we can drill down to a story that exists in the patriarchal narratives, and we can see some kind of similarity between them, then lo and behold, we have a pattern, and lo and behold, we can say something general about the text as a whole. Does that make sense? So what I want to do tonight is I want to talk about Noah and drill down into Noah's narrative and see what happens there in terms of its form, in terms of its images. And then I want to come up again and talk about what it is we've seen. And then I want to drill down into the Abrahamic cycle, into the story of Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar and Ishmael. And I want to have a look and see if there's any similarities between them. And if there are, then a literary reading will say, if you've seen a pattern, it's not by mistake. So that's the idea. Okay, so should we start with Noah? All right. I found some things that I had never seen before. It's one of those stories that you're told as a kid, I suppose, and so you don't pay attention when you read it. But I tried to pay really close attention. Now, I spoke about the biblical text's interest in the chiasmus, the cross shape. I want to have a look at the chiastic structure of the Noah story because I think it's fascinating. So tightly told. If you're interested, the story of Babel also has a chiastic structure, not only in terms of the way it's told, but the sounds that are used in each of the verses. Have a look. If you've got any good Bible with a commentary, they'll probably talk you through it. It's really interesting. Okay, so the chiastic structure of Noah's story, lo and behold, it does have a chiastic structure. I'm not expecting you to read that, by the way, but I just want you to see this beautiful structure that it's got. It goes from A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, right down to P, and then back out again. So I'll read it for you if you like. The outer bracket is Noah. Then we have Shem, Ham, and Japheth. It's really hard to say. Japheth. Thank you. Japheth. It's really hard. And then we have the ark, then the flood. So we get this kind of almost a tidal-like effect, right? The flood comes in, and then at the end of the chiasm, the flood goes out again. And then the command to cover the ark is the command to leave the ark. We're up to H, 7 days waiting for the flood, 7 days for the waters to subside, and so on and so on and so on. Okay, let's have a look at the beginning. So we've got Noah. This is an introduction to Noah. Then it interestingly gives us an introduction to his progeny, which I think is really interesting, because does anyone remember in Genesis what the command to human beings were? Be fruitful and multiply. Be fruitful and multiply. Right? So that's what the progeny is doing there. Whenever you see a genealogy in Genesis, that's what it's doing there. It's paying attention to the fact that God's original edict is being fulfilled. So Noah's progeny, the ark is built, the flood's announced, the covenant with Noah. I'm going to destroy everything, but I will protect you. Get inside the ark. Food in the ark, command to enter the ark, 7 days waiting for the flood, 7 days waiting for the flood again. Entry to the ark, Yahweh shuts Noah in. 40 days of flood, the waters increase and the mountains are covered. Now look at it the other way. Skip P for a second, because you're not meant to see that. 150 days the waters abate, the mountaintops are visible, the waters abate. 40 days, which are the end of it, Noah opens the windows of the ark, the raven and the dove leave the ark. 7 days waiting for waters to subside, 7 days waiting for the waters to subside. Command to leave the ark, food outside the ark. Covenant with all flesh. Notice how the covenant has, it's gone like that, right? It's become bigger and more expansive, which is interesting. No flood in the future, the ark. Now we're back to progeny. Why would that be important? Yeah, because they lasted.
Continuity,
because the whole of life wasn't destroyed. Be fruitful and multiply, can start again, and then we're back with Noah before he does all those dreadful things after these verses. But we'll leave that. Now, interestingly, I spoke about the importance last time about reading chiastically or chiastically. I'm not sure, quite sure what's the best way to pronounce it. But the center, of course, of this chiasm is God remembers Noah. So is the story about surviving a great big flood, says the girl from the Hawkesbury. No. No. The story is about God's remembering. The story is, in fact, about God. The story is, in fact, about his mercy, if we take the form to be representative of what it's doing. And then if we come back out to the chiasm, taking that as our punchline, God remembers Noah, then we can see that Noah's the survival of Noah's progeny is, in fact, it's God's mercy. And it's God holding fast to what he told the created daughter in the first place. So I think that's really interesting to pay attention to. I mean, apart from to marvel at the beauty of the text, right? Isn't it magnificent? It's so complex. But that God remembering Noah is the center of the text, that the mercy of God is the center of the text. Hang on, where am I? Okay. So, yes, the chiasm suggests something about the character of God. It's not Noah who's the center of the chiasmus. It's not even his obedience that's the center of the chiasmus, which you would expect from a, you know, great big moral text telling you what to do. It's not about that. It's not about Noah's righteousness. It's about God's mercy. Interesting. Or, and the other way of looking, it's also not about God's decision to judge the earth either. It's about his mercy. So, I don't know where I said this, somewhere, but in terms of judgment, I think I say that a little further on. I might leave that. Okay. So, now that we have a broad picture of the text and the way it's structured, seeing the way the chiasmus operates, let's have a look at what goes on in the syntax of the text and the images it uses. So we're going to move from the beginning of the Noah story right through to the end. And trust me, the Abraham story is even better than this one, so hang in there if you're tired. I'm going to start with Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. And the Lord saw that the evil of the human creature was great on the earth, and that every scheme of his heart's devising was only perpetually evil. And the Lord regretted having made the human on earth and was grieved to the heart. And the Lord said, I will wipe out the human race I created from the face of the earth. Whoa. So great judgment. Great judgment. In my preparation for tonight, which is interesting, I did a bit of digging around, and it appears that there are many other ancient Near Eastern texts that talk about a great deluge, a great flood. Also, these other ancient Near Eastern texts also talk about this flood happening at the hands of the gods. Not one of them talks about that event as the result of judgment for evil. Not one. Not one of them makes a causal relationship between great evil and the judgment from the gods. Now, it seems that from the archaeological work that they've done, that the Hebrew story draws from the Mesopotamian story from the Epic of Gilgamesh. The similarities, apparently, are really striking. What's interesting is not the similarities, I think, but that difference that I just spoke about. The Mesopotamian story has the gods sending a deluge either for a bit of a laugh or as a measure to hem in overpopulation. Their gods, plural, are either capricious or totally utilitarian. This God sends the deluge in response to great human evil. Prefaced, if we go back to Genesis a bit, by murder, right? Cain and Abel. That's the kind of evil, I guess, we're talking about. That's in the back of our minds if we're reading it through. So the text is really specific that the Hebrew God, Yahweh, is greatly grieved. It uses that phrase, greatly grieved. It's a really emotional response. Robert Alter, that great literary critic I told you about, the Jewish literary critic, he tells me that the Hebrew word for grieved is the same word to describe Eve's pangs, Adam's pain, and the pain of our hands work, which is interesting. So there's this deep human connection with what's going on. There are tears shed here. Utterly different to the way these other gods are represented. It's a deeply human groaning that this god feels here, utterly different to the texts that sit alongside this flood narrative. So God's judgment comes out of anguish, but judgment does come. But before it does, something very interesting takes place. And God said to Noah, I'm going to read a bit, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. Now I am going to destroy them along with the earth. Make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it in inside and out with pitch. Firstly, because I love patterns, there is this. Did you know that the Hebrew word for ark is also the same word for basket? Isn't that lovely? So your imagination should be like going crazy right now, because skip forward a book and Moses is preserved by a basket. Who is the instrument of the Exodus? Who is the instrument of God's saving grace? I'm not sure if I'm able to do this, but skip forward, you know, a few tens of books, and you've got another infant in another box. Yeah, the manger. And so I think the text is highly aware of itself as a whole here. This ark as God's protection. And I love the way I mentioned before in Psalm 149, the text's interest in things that are flimsy and frail and fragile, and that's where God's salvation comes. So in this wooden boat, and I understand it was very big, but damn it, it was wooden, floating on the raging seas. This is where God's salvation comes. So what lives inside the ark and the basket is God's instrument to bring renewal, mercy, grace. And skip your mind throughout those other instances, and then we can see some kind of pattern in which to put Genesis. The righteous remnant protected by the flimsiest of wood. Okay. Fast forward several verses to chapter 7, verse 11. After Noah has made his head count and ushered in every crawling thing, every beast of the earth, the water comes. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth and the windows of the heaven were opened. Now, a part of what it means to read literarily is to trace patterns, as I've said, to read closely with an eye on what's happened before and after so that we can place the text in its aesthetic context as well as its historical context. But I'm going to concentrate on the aesthetic context. Before this, in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, there is this account of the makings of the heavens and the earth. And God said, let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. So to make the earth, God separates the waters from the waters, and earth is that middle segment. Did you catch what it said when the rains came? I didn't as a little girl. All I heard was the rains coming. I didn't hear about these, the wells. On that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth and the windows of the heavens were opened. Water's coming from both sides, right? Now, the pattern, it's an inverse parallel with Genesis, where God makes the earth. Here, the created order is being swallowed up by the primordial waters that were previously pulled apart. It's an undoing of creation. Chaos is coming. I mentioned last time I spoke about my fascination with the way the biblical text uses water as a symbol, and it's being conscious of itself here as it does so. The Bible's preoccupation with water is here instructive. In Genesis 1, it represents the primordial waters of chaos, as it usually does, swirling with nothingness. At God's word, the water below separates from the waters above, and the earth is protected by God's good will. Remember that the earth is a marker of order, of goodness. God said it is good. Life flourishes because primordial water is held at bay. And here I'm remembering Ron's description of Zimzum and God's power to hold those waters at bay. I hope your imagination's firing again. Where else have you seen two walls of water held aside, right? so that the dry earth can appear, so that the remnant can survive. It's really interesting to me. Now, once you make the connection between the Genesis story and the Noah narrative, we import the symbol of water in with it also. Order is lost, and so life is lost. Those two are connected in Noah's story. Now, we've made a few patterns, but I also think this makes sense of some of the New Testament's use of water. All of a sudden, it makes so much more sense that Jesus walks on water, calms the storm, makes wine out of water, order out of chaos, life out of nothingness. As the incarnation of life eternal, how fitting that Jesus has control over water in all its forms. How fitting that he should be baptized in it, only to rise up through it. God's land that will never be destroyed. And so we've got Noah throwing us forward to when John baptizes Jesus. I just love the way that the scriptures use this image of water. To trace these symbols all of the way through gives us a richer understanding of both what's happening at that end and what's happening at this end, I think. The last thing I want to pay attention to in this rich text, there's so much that I could talk about and I had to really discipline myself, is the relationship between the righteous man and a merciful God. What does the Noah story tell us about this relationship, and what does this have to do with the rest of Genesis? They're the questions I'm asking myself. So let's put some of these details together. We have a created order that is both good in its gloriously alive state, but marred by evil, capitulating finally to murder, which is, of course, the destruction of life. You get it? So it's destroying itself already. Then we have God's judgment on that evil, reversing the created order and the pangs of grief. Then we have God's command to preserve a tiny bit of the populace, a remnant. And I'm going to keep using that word. And to that remnant, God not only delivers salvation, but reiterates and deepens the covenant that stood before the whole story began. You will notice that the covenant to Noah is given twice, once before the flood and once after. Did you see that in the chiastic structure? The first covenant, I'm going to read it to you, says this: I'm going to bring a flood of waters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And then after the flood, on the other side of God's remembering, comes the second covenant, this time more focused, more specific, and utterly reconciliatory. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, "As for me, I'm establishing my covenant with you and your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the domestic animals, and every animal of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of a flood. And never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the clouds and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth." I used to love that image as a little girl. I still do. We can see great rainbows in Newtown over the church. Now, I thought that the word bow was taken from the word rainbow. I established my bow. I thought he was saying, I'm establishing my rainbow in the clouds as a sign of my covenant with you. Wrong. We get the word rainbow from this scriptural reference. God literally says, I will hang up my bow. It's a sign of retirement from battle. It's actually the bow and arrow. I hang up this. We will no longer be at war, you and I. So a rainbow is actually the bow and arrow, which I thought was interesting. If you pay attention to the text, that's what it's saying. Instead of importing my childhood, I should say, I'm not sure if you committed the same sins as I did, but that's what we see here. So in this image, the writer of Genesis is communicating a God who is actively and emotionally involved in the creation he single-handedly wrought. And covenant after covenant refocuses that love, more tightly refocuses it, as we see in this Noah story. The second covenant is far more involved than the first one, far less vague. It reminds me of that beautiful hymn that I sang with Julie's girls. Here is love, tells us. Grace and love like mighty rivers, poured incessant from above, heaven's peace and perfect justice, kissed a guilty world in love. So it's the story of that paradox of God's judgment and God's love existing at the center, God remembering Noah. The middle of the chiasm, the crux of the cross, tells us God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and all the domestic animals that were with him in the ark. Amen. Okay, now I'm going to move on to Abraham. Has everyone got all that? Okay, so we're going to skip forward a few chapters. Wow.
Yay.
It's just so much to say, and I had to, like, it was so hard not to keep you here till 11 or midnight. So first of all, because it's fun, shall we go chiasm hunting? Or I'll do it for you, because there's a beautiful one. Do you want to see it? There it is. How do you like them apples? Once again, we've got the genealogical framework, which, as we've said, is a sign, actually, if you think about it, it's a sign that God was true to his promise to Noah and the covenants before then. So the genealogical framework tells us that God has been true to his word. He will never destroy the world with a flood. And then we get the migration from Haran, separation from Nahor, building of altars, the wife-sister episode. How weird is that? If my husband ever did that to me, wow, he'd be on the couch eternal. Border agreement with Lot, the Sodom episode and the rescue of Lot, the covenant of sacrifice, the expulsion and the rescue of Hagar, the covenant of circumcision, the Sodom episode, the rescue of Lot, border agreement with Abimelech, who I quite like, the wife-sister episode, the building of an altar, land secured, migration to Haran, reunification with Nahor's line, and then we finish with the genealogical framework. And in there, of course, we've got covenants delivered. You'll be the father of many nations, and so on. So it's very important that it ends with this genealogical framework. That's what they're doing there. It's tempting to skip them, isn't it? So I stole that chiasm, by the way, I just need to say. This is where Dad and I differ, so I like to cite. Sorry. That was really mean. Sorry, Dad. If you want to look him up, his name's Joel W. Rosenberg. Now, I sat there and I looked at that, and the first thing that someone who likes literature does is they look at that and think, wow, isn't that beautiful, right? And it is, isn't it? It's so tightly structured. And then I looked at it again and I thought, what? What on earth? I get all that other bit, all of that. It's a story about Abraham. That's what it's got at the front of the title, right? It's got the story of Abraham and Sarah. And we know that Abraham and Sarah, the patriarch and the matriarch, it's the same here. Abraham, Sarah, patriarch, matriarch, got it. That's where Isaac comes from. What on earth is the expulsion and rescue of Hagar doing in the middle of the chiasm? Why is that the punchline? It's so interesting. And I sat there for ages. Well, not ages. I sat there for the whole period of Trixie sleeping and thought, what on earth is that doing there? And then I read the story again and a few things started to occur to me. So if it's okay with you, I want to share them with you. Mm-hmm. Tell me if you think I'm smoking crack, to use my husband's term. I do think it's remarkable that the centre of the chiasmus is Hagar. She's a slave girl from Egypt. Crikey, how low could you get? And she's female, to make the point. She's been cast out of the family circle into the desert with only a skin of water and some bread. Because Sarah's view is that the promise given to Abraham that Isaac will be the heir is at risk because of the existence of Ishmael. If you remember the story, Sarah sees, it's just heartbreaking, I got teary reading it. Control yourself, Sarah. Ishmael, I guess, would have been, I don't know, 12 or something, playing with his new baby brother. It's 8 days after think it's 8 days. It's at the circumcision ceremony. Yep. And I guess Ishmael must have been holding his new baby brother Isaac. And Sarah sees this and thinks, bugger that for a joke. Too much of this, you know, niceness goes on and I'll be losing the covenant. So she says to Abraham, rightio, out she goes.
She's a bitch.
Hey. I can see why Sarah's desperate. Because, to come back to this, women in this world have no power except if they procreate, except if they give birth. So Sarah's screwed if she doesn't give birth. So I can sort of see Sarah's desperation, but yes, the text does position us to see not Sarah's point of view, but Hagar's. Vicious rivalry, bitter resentment, and ultimately, were it not for the grace of God, manslaughter. That's what this story could have been. And by the way, can you think of any other tensions between women and childbirth further on down the track? If you're seeing patterns all the way through, right? Leah, Rachel, and so on and so on and so on. Sarah's desperate to protect her line, which has been under threat a couple of times already. When Abraham passed her off as his sister, right? So that's where that sort of patriarchal, to use the term in a negative way, starts to look. When the matriarchal line is threatened, God's covenant is also threatened. So when he offers her to Abimelech and the other guy, I can't remember who it was, that's a sign that God's covenant was under threat because of human meddling and human stupidity. And also Sarah's barrenness. So from a little family with a whiff of a covenant, who are in exile themselves, let us remember, they're not at home, they're wandering around the desert, is a pitiful, terrible picture, and that's why I picked this painting. A lonely woman who is doubly exiled. She's not in Egypt, her home. She's with a foreign family who have kicked her out again. So she's been exiled twice. She's on the margins of the margins, this woman. Against all odds, God shows the way that his eyes rove around the margins, right? His heart is with the exiles. His heart is with the barren. His heart, I'm afraid to say, Dad, is with the women. Like Noah, remember the center of the cosmos, the chiasmus, God remembers. God remembers. And that's why I titled this whole thing tonight, His Eye is on the Sparrow. You know, even this little Egyptian girl stuck in the desert, who it seems from the Abraham and Sarah story has nothing to do with the original covenant. She's an addendum. She's Sarah's handmaid. If we take Hagar out of the story, the Israelite nation would still exist, sure. And God could say, I've honoured my covenant. It's all done. But his eye roves to the margins. His kindness and mercy expands even beyond the original covenant he gave Abraham as the father of many nations. God makes it clear that his promise will come through Sarah, sure. But his mercy expands when Sarah, in desperation and doubt, messes with it all by giving Hagar to Abraham in view of her own barrenness, right? So she gets the frights. She stuffs it all up in the first place. And instead of God leaving that to the side, flicking it out of the margins, he expands what he has to say to include Hagar also. Ishmael is born entirely of Sarah's own faithlessness. And may I say Abraham's too. Takes two to tango.
Indeed.
And in a harbinger of Jacob and Esau, and Jacob and his brothers, and in an echo of Cain and Abel, Lot and Abraham, we have two warring siblings. Or two warring figures, I suppose. But rather than consign, in Ishmael and Isaac, we have two potentially warring brothers. So on and on we go here. But rather than consign this boy and his slave mother to the dustbin, God extends the covenant to him also. And when Abraham fears for Ishmael as they go into the desert, because it says that Abraham was afraid for his son, he loved Ishmael. I liked him for that. God says this to Abraham, do not be distressed because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for it is through Isaac that offspring shall be named for you. As for the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him also, because he is your offspring. Breathtaking mercy. Breathtaking mercy. And then the narrative moves even closer to the intimate details of just how close Ishmael's death comes. And this is what I meant by that close, tight focus that the patriarchal narratives have. They get really down and dirty. You know, they're up there with Charles Dickens. When the water in the skin was gone, she cast the child under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat opposite him, a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. For she said, "Do not let me look on the death of that child." She can't watch her son die. It's too painful. She's utterly, utterly bereft. And as she sat opposite him, she lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the boy. And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What troubles you, Hagar? Do not be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Come, lift up the boy and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make a great nation of him." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. She went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. My mother's heart broke when I read that story, as you could probably tell. So utterly at the mercy of cruelty. And yet my heart is lifted with this insight, and my heart needed lifting this week. It perhaps gives me reason for its centrality as the crux of the Abraham chiasmus. What's it doing there? Like Noah, stranded in the middle of a flood, God hears, stranded in the middle of a desert. The name Ishmael means, does anybody know? God hears. God hears. And immediately after God hears Hagar crying in the desert, he hears the last wispy breaths of Ishmael under the tree. She sees the well of water in an almost inverse parallel to Noah, who sees land in the midst of the sea. Do you see that? And all of this, of course, prefigures the next test that Abraham must face as a father with his other son. First, he consigns his son to the desert and to death. And the next, he must sacrifice the heir to the covenant. I hope your imagination is running a little bit forward with the prefiguration. Abraham also miraculously sees the ram under the direction of an angel from heaven, just as Hagar did, who saves his son Isaac from death. It happens in exactly the same way. Ishmael is saved in the same way as Isaac is saved. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not lay a hand on your boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. So in the same way, the angels come at just the moment when an issue of Abraham is about to die, and they are offered mercy by an act of seeing. Genesis is, I think, interested in that motif of hearing and seeing. I want to point out some fascinating things about the Hagar story. There are two Hagar stories. Did you see that in the chiasm? Two attempts on Hagar's life at the hands of Sarah, one by passive aggression and one by outright aggression. The first was when Hagar ran away from Sarah. And the second is the one we have spent some time looking at tonight, which is echoed by the story of Isaac's sacrifice, a story on. A journey into the wilderness, an encounter with an angel, divine consolation, miracle at the site, and naming of the site. They all follow that order. So after the angel appears, do you remember Abraham setting up an altar? That was the whole purpose, right? And he prays to God, and they name the site. Well, it might not be so obvious because we don't pay as much attention to Hagar, but she does the same. She sets up an altar the first time she does it. She gives thanks to God, and she praises his name, foretelling what is to happen with her stepson. In the first casting out into the desert, Hagar responds to God as the angel appears to her. So this is the passive aggression one, not the active aggression one. "You are El Roy, which means God of seeing or God who sees. Isn't that lovely? That's her first response. It almost reminded me of Mary. The angel appearing, "You are God," is her first response. "You saw me." For she said, "Have I really seen God and remained alive after seeing him?" Therefore, the well was called Beer-lahai-roi, which means the well of the living one who sees me. Isn't that beautiful? Can we go back to the chiasmus for a minute? So you just need to think architecturally here for a minute. I wonder if in some ways Hagar's story is a microcosm of the entire Abrahamic story. Exile, wandering in the desert, life on the margins. Then an angel appears and confirms God's favor and delivers God's promise. Right? So that's what happens in Hagar's story. Now, if you widen it back out, right? If you widen it back out, you can see that same process taking place in the wider Abrahamic story. Now, why, again, do we put Hagar at the center of Abraham and Sarah's story? Well, this is my provisional thesis for the night, and I'd love to discuss it with you. But following the patterns, we have a mini version of the wider story itself, confirming God's interest in the margins, in restoring and rescuing those who are very nearly snuffed out, either by the vicissitudes of life or by infighting and cruelty. God is beyond none of it, it seems to me. That's what the text is saying. At the center of this story, as with Noah, God listens to a desperate and frightened human voice. And when he delivers his covenant again, it is more focused, it is more generous, it is more active. So I wonder if Hagar's story microcosmically prefigures what is to occur then again in Exodus. A people in exile, hungry, wandering, alone in the desert, and God hears. And it microcosmically prefigures what is to occur hundreds of years later in the figure of Jesus, also in the desert. So, okay, is everyone with me on that sort of what that looks like and what that story is doing in the center? It's like a tiny version of what's going on in the Abrahamic cycle, which I think in itself is representative of what's going on in Genesis. And interestingly, it throws me back to Psalm 149, which we read the first time I spoke to you, when we talked about the couches. Remember we spoke about that weird verse in the middle where the center seemed to be, or the crux of the psalm seemed to be, God's people resting on their couches at their most vulnerable, right? So the battle is won on the couches. So it's this interesting paradox. God's might is shown through human weakness, not through human power. Now my mind starts firing, and now I remember all of those stories that I read as a girl. Gideon, take the numbers down. On and on we go. Jericho, walking around the city, banging things for crying out loud. Can anyone my favorite. Deborah, the battle is won by one single-handed, very clever woman. Stake through the skull. So God's deliverance comes through the obedience of one very frail, very, very frightened voice. It was really encouraging to read this this week. Really encouraging to read this. I won't share that. I'll start crying. To come back to our purposes tonight, we can see a pattern emerging because of our attention to the structure and the form of Genesis. We're looking at its literary form, which has delivered us this theological pact, this theological act of discourse, if I can call it that. I don't want to call it a moral truth because it's not. It's something bigger than that. A pattern of exile, rescue, worship, expanding covenant. If we look at the two stories side by side, right, we can see the echoes backwards and forwards from the Noah to the Abrahamic cycle, right? I said before that they were from two separate parts of Genesis, but if I can throw it open to discussion now, how many similarities did you see? And if there were similarities, does that tell us something about what's going on in the broader narrative? Yeah. drawing our attention, I think, to the attributes of a living God. I can't wait to talk about it in a minute. Any aberration that human beings seem to throw at the covenant, like Hagar does with Sarah, only expands the covenant. It only makes the means of mercy greater and more creative. God's eye is ever on the sparrow, and his hand, it comforts me. To quickly come back to the patterns of rings throughout Genesis, right from, you know, the great primordial creation right through to Joseph stuffed in Egypt. In each story, be it primeval or patriarchal history, we see this same pattern. God preserves the remnant and confirms the covenant. And so what we have in Genesis provisionally is an aesthetic pattern that gives us theological shape. Be those stories allegorical or realist, the pattern is the same. And I think it behoves us to pay more attention to the pattern than it does to whether it's allegorical or not. God's eyes on the remnant and his promises hold fast. It is his power that saves, not our might. The smaller and more desperate the remnant, the greater his salvation. And I think I will stop there.